After an explosion in Poland that killed two by an apparent errant missile, what's the risk this could escalate the war?
And over the course of the past several years in which we've seen relations between Russia and the West gradually deteriorate, it's been the result of deliberate escalation more often than the result of inadvertent escalation.
The explosion in Poland came during a massive wave of Russian missile attacks throughout Ukraine.
It was the most massive attack on the energy infrastructure and on the Ukrainian cities since February 24th.
And later in the program, the results of a UN investigation into the treatment of prisoners on both sides of the war. Today is Wednesday, November 16th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The United States and its NATO allies are investigating the blast that killed two people in Sevastopol, Poland, which is located about 6 kilometers over the Ukrainian border. But early information suggests that it may not have been a missile that was fired by Russia. Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson starts us off.
Photos obtained by Reuters showed a damaged farm vehicle lying on its side next to a large crater. Ukrainian and Polish authorities said the blasts were caused by Russian-made missiles. Moscow has denied responsibility, but the incident raises fears the Ukraine war could spill over its borders. Hours after the blast, U.S. President Joe Biden convened an emergency meeting of world leaders on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Bali. Biden later said it was unlikely that the missile which struck the village was fired from Russia.
It's unlikely in the minds of the trajectory that it was fired from Russia. But we'll see.
Following Biden's comments, it was reported in the Associated Press, citing U.S. officials, that initial findings suggested that the missile that hit Poland had been fired by Ukrainian forces at an incoming Russian missile. Poland has been a member of NATO since 1999. Under Article 5 of the Defensive Alliance, an attack on one member nation is considered to be an attack on all. Two European diplomats said Poland had requested a NATO meeting within hours of the explosion under the treaty's Article 4. It states that members can convene talks when under threat. Poland's prime minister said the country was also increasing the readiness of some military units. Russia's ambassador to Warsaw has also been summoned to provide an explanation.
Flora Bradley Watson reports for Reuters News. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg updated reporters following an emergency NATO ambassadors meeting discussing Tuesday's explosion.
We have no indication that this was the result of a deliberate attack. And we have no indication that Russia is preparing offensive military actions against NATO. Our preliminary analysis suggests that the incident was likely caused by a Ukrainian air defense missile fired to defend Ukrainian territory against Russian cruise missile attacks. But let me be clear. This is not Ukraine's fault. Russia bears ultimate responsibility as it continues its illegal war against Ukraine.
It's been reported that Germany rejected a no-fly zone proposal, and Poland said it may not be necessary to invoke the organization's Article 4 clause. Zachary Pakin is a researcher at the Center for European Policy Studies and a non-resident researcher with the Institute for Peace and Democracy. He joined me via WhatsApp from Brussels over a somewhat shaky internet connection. Where I would like to begin is, the current state of events. What do you see as the impact of these latest events on the regional security there in Europe?
From what we appear to know so far, and it appears as if information may still be incomplete, but it seems to be the case that this was an errant Ukrainian missile that was trying to shoot down a Russian missile that ended up landing in Polish territory, which is certainly reassuring from the standpoint of regional security. But nonetheless, this incident does point to the fact that something like this can happen, whether accidental accidentally or deliberately. It is entirely possible that Russian missiles could end up hitting NATO territory. And of course, as Ukraine continues to make gains on the battlefield, Russia may feel that it has an incentive to escalate the conflict. And this risk has been there since the very beginning of the war, the risk that there could be an escalation of this conflict, which thus far has been limited to Ukraine, to escalate to the level of a direct conflict between NATO and Russia. It could happen via inadvertent escalation, an accidental clash or strike, but it could also happen deliberately. And over the course of the past several years in which we've seen relations between Russia and the West gradually deteriorate, it's been the result of deliberate escalation more often than the result of inadvertent escalation. So I think this just points to the precariousness of the situation we're in right now. And I don't think it's particularly helpful, before we know all the facts, when we've got some voices in the West that are immediately calling for us to escalate the situation, immediately to invoke Article 5, immediately to respond by taking drastic measures such as invoking no-fly zone or striking the Russian Black Sea Fleet. That would amount to a direct war between Russia and NATO. And just sort of saying that we can hide behind our own nuclear umbrella and that Russia would not see an incentive to escalate, having lost the bulk of its conventional forces, is a completely irresponsible thing to say. So, you know, now is the time for cooler heads to prevail. And we do need to stick with Ukraine and back it to make sure that it preserves its territorial integrity. It has already preserved its sovereignty and independence. And therefore, that's a major win. And at some point over the coming months, when the circumstances are perhaps more propitious than they are right now, we need to be looking for some sort of a way to get back to the negotiating table and towards a ceasefire.
Zachary, earlier I mentioned Article 4, you mentioned Article 5, which is commonly referred to as the Collective Self-Defense Agreement, but that's not necessarily true. What are the subtle differences between these two articles, if you could really easily explain it for an international audience?
Well, there's a difference between consultations and a difference between being able to respond militarily or via other means to an attack on one of the members. But it's worth noting that Article 5 does not trigger immediately or automatically a military response. You still have to have NATO members come together, decide to invoke it unanimously, and to be able to contribute what it is that each one of them chooses to contribute. And each one of them can contribute what they want to a certain extent. So, just because something like what happened yesterday happened doesn't necessarily mean that we're directly headed for a NATO-Russia military clash.
Zachary, there have been discussions about so-called Ukraine fatigue, that as the war continues, it becomes a day-to-day event that people start losing track of and perhaps don't want to fund support, whether militarily or humanitarian aid, for those involved in the conflict. But I was wondering what you thought perhaps the impact of this latest event across the border of Ukraine into Polish territory may have on so-called Ukraine fatigue.
Well, I think it's too early to tell specifically what yesterday's event will imply. It looks like, as of what we've seen so far, and as you mentioned, the Poles have themselves been, reticent thus far to declare or invoke Article 4, to say nothing of Article 5. It looks as if thus far this most recent event will not necessarily have an enormous impact. We're going to stay the course on our current Ukraine policy in the West, but it does nonetheless represent a bit of a wake-up call of what could theoretically go wrong. I don't necessarily think that that's going to change anything right now because, the Russian regime is still pushing for its maximalist goals. They may be pushing for them differently than they pushed for them at the beginning of the war when they were trying to seize Kiev and change the regime by force. Now they think that they can achieve their goals in Ukraine by wearing out the Ukrainian army, by targeting and terrorizing Ukrainian population centers, and by bringing about greater Ukraine fatigue by causing an economic and energy crisis in the West. But over the next year or two, they think they can achieve those goals. As long as they maintain those goals, which are still maximalist goals, because they ultimately, in their estimation, will bring about regime change in Ukraine and a different political approach towards Russia in the West, then there's very little we can talk about with the Russians. They're not a partner or an interlocutor that we can actually sit down and arrive at common positions, because the two circles of the Venn diagram between our position and their position simply would not align. So the risk of Ukraine fatigue fatigue is still there. But it's probably something that may play out over the coming months, over the course and after the winter. And it's not something that, you know, is going to change Western policy towards Russia and Ukraine today.
The Center for European Policy Studies and Institute for Peace and Democracies, Zachary Pakin. A United Nations Security Council meeting is also scheduled for Wednesday afternoon to discuss Ukraine. Russia launched its waves of airstrikes in Ukraine Tuesday, targeting 10 regions, including the capital of Kyiv. It was a military rebuke to Ukrainians reveling in one of their biggest wartime successes, last week's takeover of the key southern city of Kherson. Air raid siren alerts sounded throughout the country, and joining us from Kyiv is Anna Chernikova. Anna, it's a day later after these massive waves of Russian missiles flying across Ukraine. Can you kind of fill us in on what happened on Tuesday? After all, you were there in Kyiv, the capital, one of the regions that was attacked.
Hi, Steve. Well, yes, today is day after. And of course, this day after gets us more details and more information about what happened yesterday. So according to the latest updates that we have from the official Ukrainian sources, it was the most massive attack on the energy infrastructure and on the Ukrainian cities since February 24th in terms of amount of missiles used in just within couple of hours. It was almost 100 missiles that Russian Federation used yesterday. To be more precise, 96 missiles of different types, mostly Excalibur and X-101, X-555, and also Russian Federation used drones yesterday. So for the moment, we know that out of 96 missiles, 75 of them were destroyed by air defense. And unfortunately, in Kyiv, the debris of some of the rockets actually hit residential buildings. And we know about one victim, an older lady who was living in this residential building. It's relatively close to the city center, pretty much central part of the city of Kyiv. Most of the attacks were targeting energy infrastructure. And again, yesterday, the situation with energy supply was quite catastrophic. Half of the city of Kyiv was had no electricity, and 80% of the city of Lviv had also no electricity. However, situation is getting better now.
I wanted to continue our discussion about the missile attacks yesterday, because while you were there in Kyiv, I was here in Washington. We were messaging back and forth, and you alerted me that you had heard a missile fly overhead, and then moments later, an explosion, and then that was the point that you started going down to the bunker. So how long were you down in this safety facility? Because you are still doing reporting, you were still doing TV hits the entire time.
I was, so basically air raid siren was on for about an hour when I heard first two explosions. I heard them very precisely because the buildings, residential buildings that were hit, they are not very far from my place. Apparently, I've heard the sound of air defense. And then after that, my husband looked outside of the window and we saw a missile flying over. It was apparently it was a caliber missile. It had a little wings at the end of it. And it was flying quite low, fast but low. So it was really clearly seen. And it was flying to the opposite direction from our building. After that, we went down to the bomb shelter. So basically, we spent there at least 3 hours. At one point, electricity was down, and we were there with no electricity. However, I should say that all our friends and all the neighbors who live in the same residential building that I do, as all of the Ukrainians, are quite prepared for that already, and they know what to do. So we all had, you know, this special lightning prepared for this case. I've spent there around 3 hours.
Thank you for sharing that story. I think it's very helpful for people around the world to hear what it's like to actually go through that. I want to turn our attention back to the missile debris that landed in Poland. Both the United States and NATO are still conducting their investigation as to what happened, but preliminary results, and more are forthcoming, indicate that it may be an errant missile fired from Ukrainian territory. I was wondering if the Ukrainian government has released a statement or commented on what transpired on Tuesday.
It looks like, so again, as you correctly said, investigation is ongoing, but it looks like it could have been a missile, an air defense missile used by Ukraine to protect a western part of the country from Russian attacks. So according to what we have for the moment, representatives of the President's Office of Ukraine said that doesn't matter what investigation will find out, it is clear that responsibility should be taken by Russia, because Russia was launching all these rockets and all these missiles on Ukraine, and Ukraine was defending. However, in general, Ukraine is ready and open to be included in this investigation and to help this investigation. Ukraine, and according to the latest information, which is just in, Ukraine actually provided all needed data for the Poland side to basically conduct this investigation and to have all the data from Ukraine, according to the air defense and its operation yesterday.
From Kyiv, Ukraine, Anna Chernikova. Anna, thank you very much for not only your reporting, but for sharing your stories. Please stay safe.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Representatives from the group of 20 leading economies have ended their meeting by declaring that most of them strongly condemn the war in Ukraine. From the Associated Press, Charles Della Desma is up next.
The conflict has loomed large over the two-day summit held on Bali in Indonesia, with the G20 warning the war has intensified fragilities in the world's economy. The summit's closing declaration is noteworthy in highlighting the war, given the divisions among the group, which includes not only Russia itself, but also countries such as China and India that have significant trade ties with Moscow and have stopped short of outright criticism of the war. I'm Charles de la Desma.
Joining us from Fort Worth, Texas is Ralph Carter. He's a political science and international politics professor, as well as a Russia expert at Texas Christian University. Ralph, it's said that the G20 summit is not a political summit, it is an economic conference. And that being said, Ukraine was discussed there, although Russian President Vladimir Putin did not attend in person. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov attended in his stead. But overall, now that the conference is over, what's your takeaway?
Well, I think that, as you said, it's an economic conference, and the Russian position is that we don't want to talk about political or military matters at a G20 conference. I think the Russians have to be very happy about how the conference G20 final statement came out, where they mentioned that most members strongly condemn the war in Ukraine, stress that it's causing a lot of suffering, and they enumerated all the suffering types that have resulted as consequences of the war. But if you're Lavrov, you would say, I'm happy that it said there are other views and different assessments of the situation, and that the G20 is not the forum to talk about this. So I think that's a plus for the Russian position. It's obviously noteworthy that Putin chose not to attend in person, but the Russians, I think, got what they needed out of a very tense international meeting.
That really, you know, leads me to my second question, is moving away from this G20 summit in Bali. So as Russia moves forward, as it approaches 9 months of war, what do you see as the key geopolitical challenges facing Moscow as additional sanctions continue to be piled on the Kremlin?
Well, there's a big if involved here. That's if the Western world continues to apply the sanctions that are currently in place and continues to add new ones as new provocations occur. I think that's the big if. Obviously, the best end game for President Putin right now is to hope the West gets tired of the consequences of the sanctions on themselves, like, you know, a cold, dark winter in Europe without enough natural gas, for example. There is a real concern, and I share it, that Western countries will continue to be willing to make sacrifices for Ukraine. And I think that the UN General Assembly vote you mentioned, where fewer people voted against Russia when it actually came to reparations and penalties for Russia, really does indicate that they don't want to get more involved in this conflict than they absolutely have to.
Texas Christian University professor Ralph Carter. A team of United Nations investigators finds that both Russian and Ukrainian prisoners of war have been subjected to torture and ill treatment by their captors. Their report was based on interviews over the past several months with 159 POWs, including 20 women held by the Russian Federation and 175 male POWs held by Ukraine. Lisa Schlein
has
those details.
Only Ukraine has granted them confidential access to Russian prisoners of war in places of internment. They say Russia did not grant them similar access, so they have conducted interviews with Ukrainian POWs upon their release. Speaking from Kyiv, the head of the UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine, Matilda Bogner, says Ukrainian prisoners of war told her team they were beaten immediately upon capture. Some had their personal belongings pillaged. When they arrived at certain Russian internment centers, Bogner notes the POW said they were subjected to prolonged beatings, threats, dog attacks, were stripped and put into stress positions. She says the mission has received information that 9 POWs have died during these so-called admission procedures since mid-April. She says her team is working now to corroborate these reported deaths.
The vast majority of those we interviewed told us that during their internment they were tortured and ill-treated. Torture and ill-treatment were not only used to coerce prisoners of war to give military information or statements about alleged crimes. They were, interviewees told us, used on a daily basis to intimidate and humiliate them.
Bogner says the UN mission has documented cases of Russian POWs subjected to torture and ill treatment by members of the Ukrainian armed forces. According to Bogner, some of the men said they were punched and kicked after surrendering and when interrogated. Others said they were stabbed or given electric shocks by Ukrainian law enforcement officers or military personnel guarding them.
There have been allegations, credible allegations, of summary executions carried out by Ukrainian armed forces. These happened earlier on in the conflict. The authorities, Ukrainian authorities, have opened investigations into those allegations, but we have not seen progress in the investigations thus far.
Bogner says she and her team have not yet been to the port city of Kherson, which Ukraine recently recaptured from Russia. She notes UN monitors have conducted investigations in several nearby villages which were abandoned by the Russian forces in the past few weeks. She says they have, quote, documented over 70, almost 80 cases of enforced disappearances and arbitrary detentions in the area. She says the mission will investigate alleged war crimes and violations of human rights and international humanitarian law that may have been committed by Russian forces in Kherson. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up with the latest developments not only in Ukraine, but on news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at our website, voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow at VOA News. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.